Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulaby. Just a reminder, you can, as always, subscribe to NPR's arts channel at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, a new book dives into the cutthroat big money world of basketball fueled by shoe money and preteen athletes. We've got obituaries of two film greats and a profile of bluesman Howlin' Wolf, part of our ongoing 50 Great Voices series. But first,
I'm Miss Bonnie Parker, and this here's Mr. Clyde Barrow. We rob banks.
Director Arthur Penn, whose film Bonnie and Clyde shocked critics, inspired filmmakers, and changed the course of American film, has died. He was 88 years old. In the 1950s and 60s, Penn leapfrogged from Broadway to Hollywood to the then new medium of television. Film critic Bob Mondello offers this appreciation.
No matter what medium he was working in, Arthur Penn always seemed to be something of a miracle worker, so it makes sense that The Miracle Worker was his ticket to fame. He first directed the story on television in 1957, returned to it 2 years later on Broadway, and 3 years after that on the big screen. A wild, young Helen Keller, blind, deaf, and struggling with her teacher, Annie Sullivan, in a battle of wills that Penn staged as an out-and-out slugfest.
W-A-T-E-R, water. It has a name. W-A-T.
The Miracle Worker won Oscars for Patty Duke and Anne Bancroft, and it established Penn as a successful film director, though his career initially moved in fits and starts. He was dismissed from one project, had another butchered by his producer, and by the time Warren Beatty called him to ask if he'd take over direction of a picture about a pair of bank robbers, he was bitter about the way Hollywood had treated him. Beatty gambled and offered him final cut on the movie, a rare thing at the time, but in this case a smart bet. The result was a gangster flick unlike anything Hollywood had ever seen, an initially funny crime spree that turns mythic, becoming a mix of sex, charisma, and especially violence. Many establishment critics loathed Bonnie and Clyde when it came out, saying it was morally lacking and in terrible taste, but a few young critics embraced it, and they brought young audiences with them. It was the first picture Pauline Kael reviewed for The New Yorker, and she raved, calling it an excitingly American movie. As to the criticism that there was excessive violence in the film, Penn rejected that, as he told NPR's Terry Gross in 1998.
There's gratuitous, mindless violence, and then there is the depiction of how it really is. And I think that we've depicted that by not doing it in an ordinary reportorial style. God knows we've been imitated thousands and thousands of times now by television shows. Every time you see kind of somebody attempting violence, they go into that basic slow motion. Well, in American films, at least, we did it first.
Arthur Penn was born in 1922 to a Russian-Jewish couple, a watchmaker and a nurse, who divorced when he was three. He and his brother Irving Penn, who would later become a famed photographer, moved around a lot, and in a sense, that's the way he lived his career as well, using lulls in television to direct films like Alice's Restaurant and Little Big Man, and using lulls on film to direct on Broadway, where he staged Wait Until Dark, Two for the Seesaw, Toys in the Attic, and the Civil Rights era musical Golden Boy. Though he slowed down at the end of his career, Arthur Penn continued directing well into his 80s, both on TV and on stage, always attracted to stories of social outsiders and the chance to give one more little big man a voice. I'm Bob Mondello.
This week, the movie industry has lost not one, but two great talents. Yesterday, editor Sally Menke was found dead after hiking in Griffith Park in Los Angeles. She was 56. Menke is best known for editing all of director Quentin Tarantino's films, from his low-budget crime thriller Reservoir Dogs to last year's Inglourious Basterds. On the DVD for the film Death Proof, Tarantino explained their chemistry.
I don't write with anybody. I write by myself. But when it comes to the editing, I write with Sally. And it's the true epitome, I guess, of a collaboration, because I don't remember what was her idea, what was my idea. We're just right there together.
Earlier today, I spoke with another longtime Tarantino collaborator, producer Lawrence Bender, about Sally Menke.
I'll never forget the first time we met Sally back in 91 when Sally came in to meet with Quentin on Reservoir Dogs. And it wasn't one of these long deliberations. Quentin met her and said, that's the gal, that's my gal. And she, you know, we've known each other for 20 years now.
What do you think he was seeing in her from the very start that made him say that? That's my gal.
I think it's a combination of two main factors. One was just her personality. There's a warmth and genuineness, something that makes you feel really comfortable. And that's a really nice quality because you're going to be in that dark room for hours and hours, week after week, and just the two of you. So you want to be with someone you like. And number two, she had a great combination of things that she had edited. Some were more action-oriented and some were more character-oriented. And Quentin's stuff is kind of that combination of, you know, you need someone who could really do well with kind of more action-y stuff and obviously great characters. And so she was just the one.
And if you think about Sally Menke's sort of vision or style as an editor, what do you think set her apart?
She's just a real storyteller. I mean, one of the things you look at Quentin's movies and you look at the great characters that he has and, you know, look at Christoph Waltz or Robert Forster and Jackie Brown or John Travolta and Pulp Fiction or Sam Jackson, whatever. It's almost like there's not one bad performance. So there's no question that Sally understands performance, character, and was really able to help craft those performances that we all grew to love.
Can you think of a particular scene from a Quentin Tarantino film that really highlights Sally Menke that would look like a different movie entirely if it weren't for her?
You know, that's a good question. I understand why you would ask it. It's just really impossible to say that because, you know, they started out together. It's just impossible to even know that because those two, everything that they created in the editing room, they created together. There's been nothing created without Sally.
There is one other really sweet and funny sort of tribute to Sally Menke, which is captured on film. Quentin Tarantino had a habit of asking his actors to say hi to her as they were filming, especially when there was a blooper or a goof. Let's listen to some of that.
Look into the camera and tell my lonely editor stuck in Los Angeles, hello, her name is Sally.
Hello, Sally.
Hello, Sally.
Hey, Sally, how's it going?
Lots of hi Sallys captured on film.
You know, that's how much we love Sally because she's the one person of this, you know, such an important person, but we're out shooting. She's not there with us. She's in the edit room cutting stuff together. We're shooting. So just to let her know that she is there with us, Quentin always does these hello Sallys, we call them, and everyone gets into it on all the movies. It's always a lot of fun.
And hard to think about in the past tense, I know.
Yeah.
Well, Lawrence Bender, thanks very much for talking with us about Sally Menke.
My pleasure.
That's producer Lawrence Bender remembering Sally Menke, the editor of all of Quentin Tarantino's movies. Sally Menke was found dead yesterday in Los Angeles.
Roll A300, take one. Hi, Sally.
You'll be dropped in France. About 24 kilometers outside of Paris, the bastards will be waiting for you. So close. Hello, Sally.
Hey, Sally.
Hello, Sally.
Hi, Sally.
I think Sally's with there. Hi, Sally.
Sally, how are you? Good? A little lonely, are you? Mike says hello.
We want to turn to an educator who has just been named one of this year's MacArthur Foundation Fellows. These awards, the so-called genius grants, recognize visionary work in an array of fields. Sebastian Ruth is a violist who founded a music education program in Providence, Rhode Island. It's called Community Music Works. The program offers free music instruction to students from elementary to high school age and provides all of them with instruments and mentoring. And he's with us now from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome and congratulations to you.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
How surprised were you to get that call?
It was a pretty good call. I was driving to work, and the phone rang, and the caller from the foundation asked me to stop the car that he had something to tell me.
That was probably a good idea. Let me just read how the foundation describes your work. In contrast to many arts outreach programs, Ruth and his fellow quartet members have taken up residence within the inner city community they serve in keeping with their vision of music as a nurturing neighborhood necessity, similar to a library, a church, or a health clinic. How did you get the idea for this?
So I was an undergraduate at Brown here in Providence and was both working in a string quartet with three close friends, including my now wife, Mina. and also pursuing a philosophy of education concentration. And I was thinking about how I could meaningfully make a career in music and in a string quartet that would enable me to be performing in a way that was combining music with service, and also to experiment with ideas in education, and specifically how music education could become a transformative part of kids' lives.
Well, I want to hear more from you, and I hope you'll come back and visit with us a little bit more to tell us more about what you're doing. But I would like to ask, I think a lot of people would like to ask, what difference will this award make in your own life?
Well, you know, it's all fairly new information, and I'm still thinking through what the money will mean. I know there are some fun things I'd like to make possible at Community Music Works that this will certainly help with. And, you know, generally, as this organization has grown from its infancy into now our 14th season, we've had an opportunity to continue to ask ourselves, what are other ways that music and education and social change come together? And we continue to reinvent ourselves and reinvent our programming, albeit with the same loyal body of students. And I think this fellowship is a really nice opportunity to think what other ways are there? What are ways these ideas combine, and how can we manifest them into the world?
Well, I know that this is new news, but please tell me you did something to celebrate. Did you just have a nice glass of wine? Something?
You know, the agonizing thing is that they say you can tell one person. So my wife and I had a sort of quiet celebration, because moments after hearing the news, we walked into a quartet rehearsal with our two colleagues and couldn't say anything. So we look up between, you know, during rests in the music and sort of exchange a smile and have to keep playing. So it was a funny moment to be in.
All right. Well, congratulations once again. And we will play just a teeny bit of you playing a piece of Bach in G major, I believe it is, from the quartet as we say goodbye. That is musician Sebastian Ruth. He is the founder and artistic director of Community Music Works. He is one of the winners of the 2010 MacArthur Fellowship. He joined us from member station WRNI. And I do want to mention we will be introducing you to other MacArthur Fellows over the next couple of weeks. Mr. Ruth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
At age 9, Demetrius Walker was dunking basketballs into 10-foot-high rims. By the time he reached 11, Demetrius was signing autographs. 6 years before he was old enough for college, he got his first recruiting letter from the University of Miami. And as an eighth grader, he made the cover of Sports Illustrated. Big shoe companies were clamoring to have Demetrius wear their gear, and much of the hype was generated by the man who discovered and then later abandoned Demetrius Walker. His name is Joe Keller. Sports writer George Dorman spent 8 years hanging around Keller, Walker, and the cutthroat world of youth basketball. He tells a story in his new book. It's called Play Their Hearts Out. And George Dorman joins me from San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Most of us are somewhat familiar with the kind of high stakes involved in recruiting college basketball players, but your story starts way earlier than that. I mean, these are kids as young as 8, 9 years old playing what you describe as grassroots basketball. First of all, can you explain what this is?
Basketball is this sort of unregulated world where anybody can wake up tomorrow and start a club basketball team, recruit players, and start playing. And the best of these teams get sponsored. They're sponsored by the shoe companies, by other people, and they travel the country playing games. So there's no leagues necessarily or, you know, regions that they play under. They're sort of national teams looking for the best players, showcasing the best players.
You tell the story through Joe Keller, who was this sort of regular guy. He was in his mid-20s in the Inland Empire in Southern California. He basically scours playgrounds in his neighborhood in the area to find talented prospects to set up a team, and he basically begins to do this. And anybody can do this.
Yeah, when Joe got into coaching, I mean, he couldn't even demonstrate a proper defensive stance. He just was a competitive guy. One day figured out he could start a team. He did that. And then he went out and went to middle schools, elementary schools, playgrounds, rec centers, and he looked for those athletic kids that he felt would project to be great players. Maybe they were tall or fast, but he was sort of looking for that one or two things that, you know, held the promise of greatness.
Joe Keller is portrayed in this book as, I guess it's fair to say, a pretty extreme person. He's not a particularly skilled teacher. He seems to take advantage of these young kids to make big money, or in his attempt to make big money. Yet the kids and their parents basically trust him. How did he win them over?
Early on, Joe, I think, was sort of half good guy, half greedy. He did do some wonderful things for the boys. He, you know, he fed them, he clothed them. For Demetrius and a few others, he was truly the only father that they ever knew. So there were some redeeming qualities about Joe. But he also held this carrot out there for kids. He understood how parents, how kids dreamt of college scholarships and of the NBA. And he put that out there. He said, if you trust me, I can get your kid there.
Joe Keller eventually discovers a player named Demetrius Walker. From the time this kid is 10 years old, he's basically being touted as the best player in the country at his age. Joe basically stakes his sort of future on this kid, thinks that this kid is his golden ticket. And they develop this very odd relationship, sort of part father-son, part agent-star. How did that happen?
I think Demetrius was a, you know, kind of an old soul. He was a kid, a latchkey kid who had to grow up very fast. And Joe, at the same time, was certainly immature. They sort of came to each other, you know, Joe coming down and Demetrius going up. And their roles would kind of flop back and forth at times. You know, they were father and son. There's no question about that. But they were friends, older brother, younger brother. They just spent so much time with each other. I mean, they were never apart. So as they go forward, they kind of grow together. And really, you know, their relationship is something that I had never seen before, because it wasn't coach-player. It wasn't just father and son. It was so many things.
You basically watched him grow up, I mean, from a child to a young man. He eventually fell out with Joe Keller. How did this kid go from being Joe Keller's golden ticket to this kid that he basically froze out?
Well, two things sort of happened simultaneously, which was, one, Demetrius started to struggle as a player. He didn't have a growth spurt after 14 like Joe anticipated, so he stayed right around 6'2". And he needed to become a perimeter player, a guard, and Joe wasn't preparing him. And at the same time, Joe was making crazy money. He had come up with this idea to run all-star camps for 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. And he would sell merchandise off these camps. He had Adidas was sponsoring his camps. He was making crazy money. And at the same moment, his star was flopping. So he made this choice. He said, I'm going to take care of my family. I'm going to step away from the team and from Demetrius and just focus on my camps and making money. And it was easier to do that when Demetrius was flopping, because he now saw, well, I'm not going to make any money off this kid anyway, so c'est la vie, Demetrius, and I'm going to move on to the camps.
My guest is George Dorman. He's the author of a new book called Play Their Hearts Out. It comes out this week. I think a lot of people listening to this interview would be surprised. I certainly was when I was reading this book, to find out that shoe companies, I mean, the big shoe companies, Reebok, Nike, Adidas, are watching these kids, these 9 and 10-year-old kids play, and are trying to sort of get in there early on, and that these coaches like Joe Keller and others that you talk about are making a lot of money off of this.
We've long known that the shoe companies have worked to get in with kids who were high school age kids. They've sponsored their coaches or given their coaches money to make sure that the best high school age players, you know, wore Nike or Reebok or Adidas. But what Adidas did was they identified Joe's team, Demetrius and a couple other star players, before they reached high school. And they sponsored Joe Keller. They made Joe Keller one of their signature coaches. And this was a monumental shift. It was the shoe companies sort of crossing this hard deck that no one had crossed before, which was, we're going to market 7th and 8th graders. You know, there's a scene in the book where one of Adidas' grassroots executives talks about, you know, we want the market on Demetrius. We want, you know, people that wear his shoes. And so this was stunning, and it just showed you how far they're willing to go.
And I should point out that this still goes on. And so I'm wondering who polices all of this. I mean, it's certainly not the NBA. The NCAA isn't really paying attention to it. So how is it allowed?
Just because of the reasons you said, there are no police. You know, there's no organization, no state organization, no national organization that runs youth basketball. It is a completely unregulated subculture. So, you know, I can start a team tomorrow. I can start paying kids. I can get an Adidas deal. All of these things go on, and nobody at any point can step in and say, you know, stop this. And the only people who really have the control are the shoe companies because they control the purse strings.
And Demetrius Walker is in college now. He's about to enter his sophomore year at New Mexico, right?
Yeah, he played last year at Arizona State and then transferred to New Mexico where they play a little more fast-paced. And he's doing okay compared to some of the other boys in the book who fell out, and also just given what he went through. He really recognizes how he was taken advantage of. He recognizes that he has some serious scars and some things to overcome. But by recognizing that, he now knows, you know, this is the things I need to do to maybe, you know, get back to where I was.
What's Joe Keller doing now?
He's running his camps. He's making his money that way. But his competitive nature, which is amazing, is now focused almost entirely on his son, Jordan, who I think is around 9 or 10, his baseball career. He's got him playing club baseball. He's got a team called Team Phenom, which is a name that sort of resembles some of the things that Joe did with the basketball team. So it's amazing. I could probably sit down right now and start another book about Joe Keller and youth baseball, because it's almost like that journey is at the starting point.
That's George Dorman. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for Sports Illustrated and the author of the new book, Play Their Hearts Out. It comes out this Tuesday. George Dorman, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
His name was Chester Arthur Burnett, but he was known as Howlin' Wolf. He played harmonica, and some people say he was the greatest blues singer of all time. Howlin' Wolf's unique voice mesmerized audiences and hugely influenced rock and roll. NPR's John Burnett has this appreciation for our series, 50 Great Voices.
On a Saturday night in 1957, the marquee at Silvio's Lounge on the west side of Chicago was a blues lover's dream.
They had three bands, Howlin' Wolf Band, Muddy Waters Band, and my band.
Bluesman Billy Boy Arnold says he heard lots of great blues singers in those days, but there was never anyone or anything like Howlin' Wolf.
Well, he had the most unusual voice in the history of blues. That was his trademark. A lot of people tried to imitate him, but he just had that big, booming voice.
Well, somebody calling me.
Singer Ronnie Hawkins said it was stronger than 40 acres of crushed garlic. Bonnie Raitt said he was the scariest bit of male testosterone I've ever experienced. When legendary record man Sam Phillips first heard Wolf on the radio, he averred, "This is where the soul of man never dies." Maybe his guttural sound was a result of severe tonsillitis he had as a child, or maybe Chester Burnett's hard early years somehow came out in his voice.
It was plying four mules on the plantation.
He was born 100 years ago, black and destitute, in Clay County, Mississippi, cast out of his home, raised by an abusive uncle who whipped him with a leather plow line, so poor he once tied burlap sacks around his bare feet, and so hungry he once ate food scraps tossed off a train by railroad workers. Howlin' Wolf, like so many bluesmen before and after him, found release in music.
Tell Automatic Slim, tell Ray's Tony Jim, tell Butch and I told you Annie, tell Fast Talking Fanny, we gon' pitch a ball down to that Union Hall. We gonna romp and chomp till midnight. We're gonna fuss and fight the daylight. We gon' pitch a wang, wang, doodle all night long.
While he was a young man sharecropping in Mississippi, Wolf apprenticed with Delta Blues legend Charlie Patton. And as Wolf said on a Chess record in 1968, he was deeply influenced by Patton's gritty singing and percussive playing.
I liked his sound. And so every night that I'd get off of work, I'd go over to his house and he'd learn me how to pick the guitar.
so I got good with it.
Wolf started playing on weekends in country juke joints, then moved to Memphis, made a name for himself, and finally settled in Chicago to become, literally, a giant of the blues.
Hoy, hoy, I'm the boy. I got 300 pounds of a heavenly joy. I'm so glad that you understand. I'm 300 pounds of a muscle and man.
He's a big man, goes out 16 shoe, and his stage presence. And when he talked or sang, I mean, people listened to him, you know.
Jody Williams played guitar alongside Hubert Sumlin in Wolf's band in 1954, and of all the famous musicians Williams backed up, Bo Diddley, Memphis Slim, Big Joe Turner, Wolf is the one he remembers best.
He even went outside the door of the club. He had a long, about 100-foot cord on his microphone. So Hubert and the rest of the band and I, we were on the stage playing, and Wolf just howling and singing the candle. So he went out the door, down the sidewalk to the corner, and he's just blowing his harmonic and howling and candle. But that was the Wolf.
That was the Wolf.
Wolf would crawl around on his hands and knees, and he'd howl like a wolf.
Mark Hoffman is co-author of Moanin' at Midnight, The Life and Times of Howlin' Wolf.
He'd pound on the stage, and people would watch him. They just couldn't take their eyes off him.
With his feral stage presence and growling vocals, Wolf fought his way to the top of the cutthroat Chicago blues scene during the 1950s, neck and neck with his rival, Muddy Waters. In the 60s, young white rock and rollers discovered his music and began to cover his classic renditions of Little Red Rooster and Spoonful. In 1965, the Rolling Stones, fresh from England, appeared on the ABC TV show Shindig. They had one condition: their idol, Howlin' Wolf, had to be there too. A hulking black eminence stands at the microphone in a dark suit, his huge head sweating, stabbing the air with his finger, shaking his hips salaciously before a bevy of white go-go dancers.
How many more years to buy to let your dog be around?
It's surely one of the most incongruous moments in American pop music. Music journalist Peter Guralnick, who reveres Howlin' Wolf, goes even further. He calls it one of the greatest cultural moments of the 20th century.
What was so great about seeing Wolf on Shindig was it was, in a sense, reality imposing itself on this totally artificial setting. And while, you know, the Stones, I was a big fan of the Stones, and seeing them on the show was exciting and everything, but it was altogether appropriate that they would be sitting at Wolf's feet. And that's what it represented. I mean, his music was not simply the foundation or the cornerstone. It was the most vital thing that you could ever imagine.
Oh, smokestack lightning, shining just like gold. Why don't you hear me cry? Ooh, 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 ooh. I had a woman once. She was kind of nice to me, and she pulled off and left me, and that gave me the blues, sure enough. I went to howling like a dog then, you know what I mean? Oh, don't you hear me cry?
Since Chester Burnett died 34 years ago, there's been a postage stamp with his face on it, a statue in his hometown, a blues festival in his name, and numerous Hall of Fame inductions and record reissues. The Wolf keeps howling. John Burnett, NPR News.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to NPR's arts channel at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.